Today on Against the Grain. Many assume that the majority of people living on the streets struggle with mental illness or just need jobs, and that homelessness is unfortunate but intractable. Longtime advocate for the unhoused, Mary Brosnahan, argues that these are myths and that much of what we assume about homelessness is wrong. She posits that at its root is the capitalist commodification of housing, illustrated in the past by Bronx landlords getting rid of low-income tenants by burning their buildings to the ground, to the systemic shortage of affordable housing today. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since the dawn of capitalism, people without housing, and poor people in general, have been demonized and judged unworthy of aid. Those without a place to live today are the subject of a multitude of ill-informed assumptions about their circumstances, which Mary Brosnahan has sought to challenge in her book, They Just Need to Get a Job, 15 Myths of Homelessness. She led New York's Coalition for the Homeless for 30 years. I'd like to start by asking you, who are the unhoused? Do the homeless tend to be single people living on the streets, as most people assume?
Well, I think, you know, our perception is our reality. So a lot of times when we see homeless people, they are single adults living on the street. But actually, that's one of the biggest myths. Most homeless people are sheltered, and of those people who are sheltered, the majority are families. And so, although the people we see on the street tend to be single adults, the majority, 40%, are families that are homeless. Only 3% of families who are homeless are living rough on the streets. I'm talking across the country. It obviously is worse in certain localities, but that's one of the biggest myths, that most homeless people are single adults.
And it sounds like tied to that is the definition of homelessness itself. So when you say live sheltered, what do you mean? How do we define this term homelessness?
Well, that's a great place to start with. You know, which this new term unhoused has become more popular. I mean, there's a continuum. There are many more people who are living in doubled and tripled up situations. And so, you know, just starting with the HUD definition of homeless people, we're talking about people who literally have no fixed abode, who are either on the streets living rough or living in temporary emergency shelters. So for the purpose of my book, I'm not dealing so much with that larger population of people who, you know, are living doubled and tripled up, but the people who are literally homeless.
Do we have reliable numbers about how many people that encompasses?
That's getting right to the heart of the issue. HUD, which is Housing and Urban Development, the federal part of our government that deals with this issue specifically, does something called a point-in-time count every year. Unfortunately, they do it in the dead of winter, and where they send people out to enumerate people on the street. And so, as you can imagine, that methodology is fraught with error. And so right now, approximately for the past couple of years, they've estimated that there are roughly 500,000 people literally homeless. But those of us who are working in the community know that that's really a vast undercount. We imagine that there's, you know, at least double, sometimes triple that amount of people. And then you have localities like New York, which have a right to shelter. So this evening, for instance, just in New York City alone, in setting aside the migrant population, there are close to 100,000 New Yorkers living in emergency shelters in New York City.
Enough to be a large city in themselves. So as you point out in your book, so many of the myths around the homeless really serve to dehumanize them. So before we get into those myths, I just wanted to ask you, what does living on the street or in shelters do to one's health and one's life expectancy?
One of my big heroes, Jim O'Connell, who has been on the front lines, a physician on the front lines up in Boston, has worked with homeless people living rough in Boston. And he's done some extraordinary work, both just academic work and obviously his frontline humanitarian work. And what we see is a dramatic decrease in life expectancy for homeless people, all kinds of problems that homeless people get into just simply because they can't access reliable health care, but also just the sheer violence of being outdoors, not being able to lie down, for instance. That causes all kinds of circulatory problems. And also, what people don't seem to understand is even if it's not 32 degrees or below and actually freezing, homeless people are at extreme risk of bodily harm. Jim talks about this whole phenomenon of people not realizing that it's humidity or dampness in the air combined with ambient temperature. And so, for instance, I was just remarking earlier to a friend that it's 40 degrees here in New York, which seems almost balmy, but it's also about to get wet. And so that is the sort of situation where homeless people might not realize just how much danger they're in and that they ought to be seeking indoor shelter just to preserve literally life and limb.
So is homelessness a relatively new problem in the United States, or does it have a persistent history here and in other advanced capitalist countries?
Well, that's one of the main myths. You know, there are 15 that are sort of articulated in the book, but one of the main myths that I was hoping to expose or explode is that homelessness is a relatively new phenomenon in the U.S. What we see is that there's been homelessness since, the colonial days here in America. But when you track the actual ebb and flow of homelessness, it tends to very much mirror the economic tides of our country. In other words, when things were bad, homelessness would swell. And then when we would have an economic recovery, things would get better. And so although we've had homelessness in our country since its founding and before, what's different about this era is that we have increasing homelessness, which is steady and alarmingly on the increase. And it's not sort of tethered to any economic fortunes of the larger population. Let's focus on the second half of the 1800s, where you had wild swings in economic tides, where there were myriad depressions and recoveries, boom and bust. And you would see, you know, just based on the available data, that homelessness would expand and contract. But when you get into the, obviously that culminated in the Depression and all kinds of good things that happened under FDR and the New Deal and those sort of guardrails put in place. When we get into later, into the 70s, Reagan, post-Reagan, when those guardrails are stripped away and we see the commodification or the hyper-commodification of housing, now we start to see a group of homelessness that, you know, may have, you know, the early harbingers of which were single adults on the street, which seemed to appear out of nowhere, but obviously there were roots surrounding that. But increasingly we see families, we see people who are living paycheck to paycheck. And because of the shortage of housing, now we just have this sort of undergrowth of people that continues to expand, and it sort of seems to become entrenched. And people, I'm sure we'll get into this later in the conversation, sort of give up hope. They see this and they just either throw up their hands or just think, well, this is just one of the costs of this sort of late capitalist era that we've entered.
And we'll return to our times and to Reagan. But I wanted to ask you about the history of homelessness in the city where you live and have worked for decades around homelessness, New York City. If you could tell us the history of homelessness there and the role of the state in displacing poor people.
I think it's a fascinating microcosm, which played out in other coastal cities, by the way. And what you see is government-engineered homelessness. In New York City in particular, there were specific laws passed by the city government and the state government, which outlawed SRO housing, single-room occupancy housing, and really set up inducements for landlords to not only destroy single occupancy housing, but make it much more profitable for them to replace that cheap housing stock with luxury housing or market rate housing.
And just to jump in for a second, so single occupancy housing is like a single room in a building where somebody, a low-income person, could live presumably at a fairly affordable level and had been ushered in New York in the late 19th century, but then demonized as sites of dissolute behavior.
Right. SROs were seen, you know, in the early 1900s as something good, as a place where, for instance, young men and young women could go and get their toehold and move on as they became more prosperous. But it became demonized, particularly after World War II, and were seen as sort of locus of dysfunction and blights. And it's also a place where, because it was affordable, and at that point, folks who were living on welfare, who were recently discharged from psychiatric hospitals, could find rooms. And even if they were displaced from that room, they could literally walk around the corner and find another cheap room. When the hammer came down and there was a massive push to get rid of hundreds of thousands of units of SRO housing, that's the causality that you'll see when you see those first folks in the late 70s appearing on the streets. So you have all of that going on, and then you have another really astounding situation in the Bronx on the Lower East Side, but best known in the Bronx, which was the whole-scale destruction of larger buildings that were burnt down for profit by landlords. And, you know, you sort of see this wedge where we're losing, hemorrhaging hundreds of thousands of units of housing. And so it's not that crazy to think that, well, where are all these people going to wind up?
Well, tell us more about what happened in the 1970s and 80s in New York. You know, the burning of the Bronx was memorialized at the time in a somewhat befuddled way by the larger public, that people in the Bronx were, you know, burning down their own neighborhoods. What actually took place there, and how was it connected to this drive to get rid of single room occupancy housing that had been so crucial for people who ended up then becoming displaced onto the streets?
Yeah, there was a famous moment. It's one of those famous quotes that isn't quite right. And since I'm a sports fan, I find this particularly fascinating. During the World Series up in the Bronx, there was a moment when Howard Cosell supposedly said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Bronx is burning." He didn't actually say those very words, but the camera did pan up and you could see two large fires going, and there were buildings burning to the ground at that moment. And the background on this is really compelling, in that because New York City in the 70s was under tremendous financial straits, fiscal straits, and because particularly Gerald Ford and the federal government were unwilling to offer any assistance, what we saw was that the mayor at the time hired the RAND Corporation to do an analysis about how to save money. And they zeroed in on the Bronx, and they showed that the response time for fires up in the Bronx was relatively short from the time that somebody reported a fire and the fire trucks actually showed up. And the reason, instead of looking at that as a good thing, was that because the fire department recognized that the buildings in the Bronx, which had not been updated for many decades, were overcrowded and essentially fire traps, but they were housing literally hundreds of thousands of low-income New Yorkers. And so instead of looking at this as a good thing, the mayor decided to follow the RAND Corporation. We don't need to even get into their history. They were pivoting from their horrific proposals to the federal government on Vietnam. They told them to close many of the firehouses. And so as this was sort of transmitted into the popular press, we got the image of disorder, of people torching their own homes, when in fact what was going on was that landlords were seeing that some buildings were catching fire. The FDNY had been cut to the bone and were not able to respond in many instances in time. And they made the very horrific decision that they'd rather burn the place to the ground and cash in on their insurance policies rather than invest in making these buildings habitable. And so you see the sort of hand in glove, instead of government working for the people, government working, in this case, the absence of intervention by allowing the owners, the capitalists, to cash in and desert the neighborhoods. And I think most recently, you're probably familiar with the famous picture of Jimmy Carter, since he just passed away, standing on the street corner in the Bronx, and it looks like Dresden, after World War II. And, what's missing is the whole context of how Democratic governments or Republicans in Washington worked hand in glove with the owners, with the capitalists, to decimate that area and leave hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers without any place to turn.
Mary Brosnahan is my guest. We're discussing her book, They Just Need to Get a Job, 50 Myths of Homelessness. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, taking things up then through the 70s and 80s, you argue that there was, in fact, something that took place in that period and since then that has intensified homelessness, so that although homelessness has existed in U.S. history, tied to both the booms and busts of the economic business cycle and also related to war, that in our period we have persistent mass homelessness that's not tethered to those. Many people on the left assume that Reagan was responsible for creating contemporary homelessness. And although you're not taking him off the hook,
not by any means.
Can you tell us why Reagan and the closing of mental health facilities under Reagan is not the whole story?
Not to be provocateur, but one of the myths I lay out is that Ronald Reagan created modern homelessness. Certainly, as I'm sure we'll get into, he had a large part in accelerating it, but the seeds of modern homelessness were laid back starting in 1963 when JFK had his very well-intentioned deinstitutionalization bill in Washington. But the key to the success would have lied in harnessing the hundreds of millions of dollars that were to be saved by closing down the horrific state mental institutions, and the assumption that various states would use that savings to reinvest in community-based treatment, including supportive housing. And instead, every one of them universally used that money for other purposes, many times to balance their state budget and many times to give tax cuts to wealthy Americans. And so none of that money followed people into the communities. And so you have, on the one hand, these large places that, Willowbrook, or there are many of them across the country that were notorious and rightfully were exposed and shut down, but none of the savings actually followed people into the community. So there you have the first seeds of what is going to amount to the catastrophe that we're looking at right now.
And then what role did Reagan play in fanning the flames and those who came after him, Democrat and Republican?
In The Nation, there was a remarkable analysis done that fully 60% of aid to localities, meaning federal government money that was going into cities to support everything from libraries to housing to senior centers, 60% was cut. And so, you know, we see that even though I wouldn't say he caused homelessness, he certainly accelerated it and played a very important role in terms of attitudinally what people thought of homelessness and what the problem was. He famously, in 1983, went on Good Morning America, and when confronted with, you know, the sudden emergence across the nation of people living rough and folks were shocked, he literally said people were homeless by choice. And I think that that gave the average person cover to point to the victims and say, oh, I see, it's their problem. And this is a myth that continues to persist to this day. And we see it amplified by tech bros like Peter Thiel and Joe Lonsdale and others, that really people are on the street because they want to be on the street, and that it's their dysfunction that actually makes them deserving of living on the street. So Reagan played a pivotal role in terms of increasing the misery on the streets and hacking away relentlessly at the HUD budget. And then, you know, if you want to just fast forward to Bill Clinton, the Clinton quote-unquote welfare reform really was a death knell in terms of providing cash assistance to needy families. He came in, he actually ran on one of his main tenets was, we are going to end welfare as we know it. And he brought in great people to try to do welfare reform the right way, which would be to provide job training and support for people. But he realized early on that that was going to actually cost more than what existed at the time. And so in tandem with Newt Gingrich, he basically just blew up the system. And so what we have today is temporary aid for needy families. And the actual rigorous examination of what's happened is that at the time when Clinton came into office, approximately 68% of families got cash aid, and now we're down to maybe 21% of people who deserve to have cash aid available to them. And for folks that are listening and thinking, well, what's the big deal about cash aid? The thing that makes cash aid so valuable for families is its flexibility. In other words, you know, this week it might be that your kid has to have new sneakers, or you need more money to pay for medication. That type of flexibility was intentionally stripped away. And a lot of that money, and the states now can basically determine how these TANF grants are used. So I get into the detail in the book where an alarming portion of these, what should be direct aid to families who are really in dire poverty, wind up going to things like college scholarships for middle-class people, and all sorts of things that really are not tackling the root issue of really desperate poverty.
One of the things that stands out when thinking about homelessness over centuries, in fact, and Clinton, of course, manifested this as well, the idea that there are worthy poor people who deserve our help and others who are unworthy and therefore undeserving. Can you tell us about that history and how that has shaped the way people talk about homelessness and the problem of those without housing in a way that puts it persistently on the people themselves who are struggling without housing?
Sure. And that's like, if I was to pick, you know, a couple huge myths, that would be, you know, top of the list. You know, going back to when we had the enclosure era, and I know this is going way back into the, say, 1200s back in England, what you see directly following that and what happened was that you had this radical shift where the majority of people who were without title in England used to live off the land. And we're very familiar with the Magna Carta. It's basically outlines many of the personal rights that we see here in the U.S. Based on this ancient text from England. What people don't understand is what we consider the Magna Carta is only one half of the Magna Carta. There was a separate Magna Carta for people who were living off the land, which enumerated rights that they should have. And in the process of this enclosure area, where essentially the king granted land grants to his wealthy friends, his lords and barons, people were forced off the land. And this was, you know, the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. They were forced off the land and into industries that were emerging. And so they basically were forced into a wage-based economy. What happened, or what, you know, the downside of this very quickly were the people that couldn't be accommodated in this new economy, this new economic model, and what were we going to do with them? And so we had these parishes, these localities in England dealing with dire poverty. And so there were a whole slew of what we now know as Elizabethan poor laws that were enacted. And the essence of it is, one, you had to prove that you were from that locality, which obviously will have ramifications present day about the migrants, but also that you had to prove that you were worthy of receiving assistance. And so you had different categories that emerged of people. The one enduring one are sort of widows and children. Orphans are always held relatively harmless. But people who are deemed unworthy are the people who can work but seemingly don't, quote, want to work. Not that they can't find jobs, but that they don't want to work. And that whole framework was imported to our nation when it was first set up. And you start to see very early on the same sort of rubric of, well, worthy versus unworthy. And I just also want to footnote here that I would not champion the Catholic Church on many things, but I will say that up until, you know, Henry VIII and the whole revolution that took place underneath him, there were charities. Charity was something that was actually championed. It was seen as something that was preached by in the Bible, by Jesus. It was championed. And then you have not only the Reformation, but we have almost the extreme Reformation that is lensed through the Calvinists. And not only did the Calvinists not think that charity was good, they thought it was bad. In other words, that people were preordained to get into heaven. And one of the tags, if you were, of people that were preordained were people who were successful, who were diligent and were able to work and save money. And you see this literally imported into the U.S., where you have the Pilgrims and others who came here. The Pilgrims were more radical and actually rejected the Church of England. But you have the Calvinists who show up, and this is just so ingrained. It's just threaded throughout everything in our nation about people who are not successful, who haven't been able to amass capital, are seen as somehow unworthy of our support. And people willingly look away from these extraordinary currents, these, you know, titles, waves that are underneath, that are actually forcing people increasingly into dire and continued poverty.
Right, and as part of this latter-day version of the Calvinist ethos that some people are just not worthy of help, is that if they were more functional members of society, not just getting jobs, but if they learned how to save, that they would then be able to get out of the state of being homeless. Tell us about how you see that today.
Well, one of the most recent manifestations, this sounds like a small aside, but I think it's very telling, is when Mike Bloomberg, who is a billionaire, was our mayor, he decided that he was going to force people in the homeless shelters. And by the way, you know, upwards of 40% of the people, not even in the shelter system, but living on the street, have jobs. But they use the money that they're earning for subsistence. And he was going to force them to turn over part of their wages to the city to pay for shelter. There's such a massive outcry because it just made absolutely no sense. Like, how do you expect these people to get ahead if they have to pay for congregate shelter? And it was one of the few times that he was forced to publicly back down. And the comment that he made to me at the end of a press conference was, "See, Mary, the thing is, these people need to learn how to save." And it really struck me as so tone deaf, not that these people don't have enough to save, but that somehow they're lacking in either the resolve or the actual money to put aside to build up wealth. And, you know, I think that that's worth pausing and thinking about. I think that people like Noam Chomsky and Joseph Stiglitz and some of the more progressive economists have pointed out, and I think that this is actually just in the last month or so become an even larger rallying call and enlightening point for people to reflect upon, that we see this massive polarization in wealth. Those people are not getting wealthy through work, through labor. They're getting wealthy through the lack of capital gains tax. They're basically accumulating capital because of the understructure of our economy, the massive deregulation that took place under Reagan and continued right through Obama. There's been a massive shift in how our economy functions, and that this 1% that we keep referring to, they didn't get that way because they're smart. They're getting that way because that's how money works. That's how the system works. They get a toehold with a significant amount of capital, and that allows them to draw in more capital. And that's why housing plays such an important pivotal role in all of this, because increasingly these oligarchs, these millionaires, these billionaires are pouring that money into real estate because it's a very liquid asset, and they're able to park their huge bundles in places like London, New York, the Gold Coasts of the country, and increasingly now it's infiltrating through BlackRock and other corporations into the heartland of America and sort of tilting the board. People are finding that they can't find quote-unquote starter homes for themselves because they're up against these massive corporations that have accumulated capital. It's no longer a level playing field. And homelessness and the whole real estate component is central to the misery that we're seeing around us.
Mary Brosnahan is my guest. She's a longtime advocate for the homeless. We're talking about her book, They Just Need to Get a Job, 15 Myths of Homelessness. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So that commodification of housing, or the hyper-commodification of housing, that has accompanied or been a feature of the neoliberal era since the 1970s and has absolutely intensified in our recent decades, is one part that you argue is absolutely central to understanding why so many people find themselves without housing. But there are those who argue, and many of them work around either the issues of homelessness or policy around it, that housing is not the issue. The commodification and lack of access to housing isn't the issue. That there are people without housing who just don't use the low-income housing that exists, and in effect, more outreach is necessary. That people need to reach out to these people, but actually funding housing is not the issue. Tell us why you feel like that is based on a myth.
I'll just tell you from personal experience that this is not a communication issue. And this is one of the things that sort of drives me and a lot of folks that are on the front lines and crazy, is that you can send all the outreach teams you want to try to, quote, engage people. But if what are you offering these folks? I will tell you, just recently in New York, you know, Eric Adams likes to point out that he removed thousands of people from the subway system. And Brad Lander, who is our comptroller, went back and looked at and found out that of the thousands of people that were removed, only four of them wound up in housing. And so what happens to the other, you know, thousands minus four, is that they just continue through this broken system. In other words, we need to ask ourselves, what is on the other side of that door? And I think that this is imperative, especially in places like New York and California, where you have Democrats like Gavin Newsom, Eric Adams, Kathy Hochul, who are pushing to actually reduce the threshold by which homeless people with mental illness or any person who is seen as being mentally ill can be forcibly hospitalized. And this is the flashpoint right now that we find ourselves at. You know, Gavin Newsom successfully partnered with his tech bros to petition the Supreme Court to essentially criminalize homelessness. In California, and in many other localities, thanks to the Supreme Court, it is illegal for someone to lay down and put a blanket over themselves at night. That in and of itself is grounds for arrest and removal. Going back to the Elizabethan era, you know, this is exactly like, we don't want you laying down on our property, our public property. And so we really have to get back to the fundamentals. I think that this whole debate has become polarized. And one of the most frustrating things is you'll have people like Democrats and Republicans in lockstep saying, we need to force people into, whether it's available resources or into forced hospitalization. And then you have civil libertarians screaming that it's about individual rights. And if you're on the front lines, it's really about what is practical, what is really going to solve this issue. We all know that on the other side, there are no long-term hospital beds. And moreover, what's at the end of that long-term hospitalization? Hospitalization itself is not a plan. What happens to people after we've stabilized them? Is there a place that they can go to, a permanent facility where they can get ongoing help, where they can be stabilized? And by the way, if they decompensate, they can go to the hospital knowing that their home will be waiting for them when they get back. This is the key, that there has to be a real system. There just can't be this continued carceral approach by Democrats on both coasts to say, we're just going to clean up this problem and we're going to force people as though there actually are meaningful solutions for folks that are on the streets.
Let me ask you about the component of mental health. Are most people with insecure housing people with persistent mental illness?
No, that's another myth. I think, you know, the estimates of people who are on the street run about a third of people with severe and persistent mental illness. There is also a segment that have abuse issues, substance use issues, and there's obviously some overlap between that because people are self-medicating. But the majority of people on the street are not mentally ill. And so, again, it just shows you how dire the situation has become, particularly for single adults, because, again, going back to that matrix that goes way back into, you know, the 1200s in England, single men in particular are deemed as unworthy of assistance. And so they receive virtually no federal aid whatsoever. It's jaw-droppingly small, and it's regulated by the state. So in New York, it's a pittance per week that they're quote-unquote entitled to.
Well, in terms of, quote, solving the problem of homelessness, is funding the problem? Is the state not being willing to pony up the money the issue? Or is it actually also expensive to have people in this dire situation?
That's such an excellent point that I think we can all agree on. If you look at where does this carceral approach lead us, you know, it costs over $100,000 to put somebody in a jail cell. It costs roughly $70,000 to keep people in a bed in a congregate shelter. Costs a fraction of that to actually put them in supportive housing. What we need is the upfront capital commitment to build that housing. And we also need, and one of the things that I get into the book, is really looking at the non-market housing that used to be championed ubiquitously by Democrats from FDR through JFK. And instead, what we have is any respect or appreciation of what non-market housing can do as a pillar to actually raise up communities. Here in New York City, we have a fantastic place called Penn South, and it's one of many limited equity co-ops that exists that were actually funded not only by the government, but by unions going back to the 1930s. And these remain sort of harbingers of of excellence, of beauty, of thriving communities. And, you know, I sort of drill down in the book of one instance. You know, everybody's familiar with that moment in our shared history when Marilyn Monroe serenaded JFK at Madison Square Garden with Happy Birthday. Much less well known is that earlier in the day, he was at Penn South, which is over on 8th Avenue and 30th Street, and for a ribbon cutting ceremony where he was serenaded by tens of thousands of union workers. And he gave such a magnificent speech, very short. It's available through WNYC, which is the public radio station here in New York. And it's really soaring just to listen to his short remarks and him talking to people about how the work is not done. Like, people were telling him that the work was done by FDR and that he was a caretaker. And he pushed forward, and it was really that message that we need to invest, even if not for ourselves, for our children. He ended his remarks with a famous story about a French general who told his gardener to plant a certain tree, and the gardener said, "But that tree won't bloom for 100 years. And he remarked, "Well, it's best, you better plant that tree this afternoon," meaning that we need to get to work building not only for ourselves, but also have a vision for what we want our children to inherit.
Tell us more about the idea of non-market housing. The U.S. has a longer history of co-ops in housing than I think many people realize. And yet there's this persistent assumption that social housing, public housing doesn't work. It leads to all these social ills. Tell us about that history of social housing and co-ops and why you think that it is essential to be thinking about that kind of history now, that providing housing within the market is not going to solve the problem.
It's twofold. We can talk about housing first, which is proven to actually eradicate homelessness if you look at countries like Finland. But in the 20s, some pretty radical union leaders realized that their partners, their members, were being fleeced by landlords, and that they weren't able to ever find, permanent housing or a place where they could put down roots. So there were visionaries like Abraham Kazan, who was part of the Amalgamated Textile Union, actually led it. And he was able to work with a lot of different people, including, believe it or not, Robert Moses, to build some of these extraordinary units that still exist today. And the idea is that rather than building up a series of buildings for people to flip. In other words, like when we think of co-ops, we think of high-end units that people are, you know, finding a moment to cash in on and make their big payday. Instead, they kept the equity and returned the savings into making those buildings better places. And so you certainly could sell your unit, but it was capped at who, how much, and who the income level of people that were coming in. And what we found is that the quality of life in those communities is much higher than the surrounding ones. And so I think we have a very narrow vision of what, quote, public housing looks like. And it was intentionally marginalized and built in a certain way. But I hope one of the things my book does is invite people to expand their horizons and look at places like Vienna, where in the aftermath of World War I, invested huge amounts of money into making a whole different type of non-market housing, where the majority of people still live today. And Vienna was voted the most livable city in Europe, largely because they have this beautiful, vibrant, interconnected network of non-market housing. And it's one of the things that makes people abide there and want to move there. It's a magnet. So this idea of, if you don't marketize this and allow it to be hyper-commodified, people will not care about it. In fact, if you look at places like Vienna, or if you look at the Housing First model in Finland, What we see is that investing in what we know works actually makes the whole community much more livable. It helps not only our homeless neighbors, but it helps us, those that are lucky enough to have homes, live better lives.
You mentioned a few minutes ago housing first, and I wonder if you could explain what that approach is and how it contrasts with treatment first. What are these approaches to homelessness rooted in?
Well, Housing First is a very radical approach, seemingly, where, and I know it well because my late husband was one of the pioneers, along with other people here in New York, working at a place called Pathways for Housing. And the idea was that rather than having hoops for people to jump through, why don't we target the most marginalized, the most difficult people, and tell them that we will take you off the street and put you directly into housing. And believe me, in many instances, the people on the street were completely in disbelief because, you know, they've been told 1,000 times 8 different things, and then they wind up in a van going to a congregate shelter. But when they're brought to actually a unit of housing with a door that closes and locks and it has a bathroom and a kitchen, they are astounded and they agree to stay. But the key is, obviously, that the staffing is, I hate this word robust, I'm trying to find a better word for it, but the staffing is absolutely 1,000% committed, not just to put people in that housing, but to be there day in and day out for them, to visit them. I mean, to be honest with you, to go from the street into a housing unit sometimes can be disorienting and a pretty lonely place. I'll just tell you one story that has always stayed with me in John's work is that he housed a woman, a former nurse, who was living on the median strip on Upper Broadway, and she was in disbelief. She couldn't believe that he was actually offering her housing. He got her there, and he, you know, they had the little welcome package of, you know, a dish drainer and, you know, bathroom stuff and a bed and so on. And then he said to her, "Is there anything else you need before I leave?" And she said, "Yeah, I need a tent." And he went out and bought a tent and came back and put it up with her in the living room. And he kept going back every day and talked to her and got her connected with a psychiatrist, got her on her medication, and I think it was about 6 weeks later, the tent came down in the living room. But it's that kind of counterintuitive approach that people want, at the end of the day, what we all want. We want a door that locks, we want privacy, and we want security, and that leads to dignity. And if you follow that, and if you believe in that, Housing First is a remarkable model. In Finland, where they decided that they had had enough of this revolving door, they decided to go all in on Housing First, they have essentially eradicated street homelessness. My good friend Mark Horvath runs a group out in California called Invisible People. And I really would urge listeners to go online, just type in Invisible People Finland, and watch a 20-minute documentary that Mark did in Finland with these wonderful people who have gone all in on it. And it's not sugarcoated. I mean, you will see when some of those doors open on some of those units, it's not the tidy thing that you would expect. But the point that one of the workers makes that I think is worth really taking home is that, you know, you can have that mess here or you can have it out on the street. We'd rather have it here and we'd rather work shoulder to shoulder with those people to make their lives a better place.
The discussion around people without housing in cities and around housing more broadly, although there certainly has been a lot of activism by people on the left who are recognizing that housing is such a crucial fight to be waged. But at the same time, in many large cities, the conversation gets framed as one about removing all impediments to development, completely deregulating housing. And especially epitomized by those people who call themselves YIMBYs, yes, in my backyard. Tell us about why what might sound like a movement or an effort, let's say, of those who are saying, yes, we need more housing, is not at all what is necessary to address this broader issue of housing and particularly that of the homeless.
I'm so glad you brought that up because do we have a housing crisis? Yes, but what we have moreover is an affordability crisis. And one of the great tragedies is that the YIMBY group, and this movement was birthed and has been given tremendous life by technocrats out in San Francisco. I spent my whole life fighting NIMBYism, which is not in my backyard. I mean, I fought many battles here in New York with people who just simply didn't want, quote, those kind of people next door. And so in a brilliant marketing stroke, these technocrats who, again, need some place to park their billions of dollars have weaponized a large cadre of young people into believing that we just need to deregulate everything and that somehow that is going to solve our housing crisis. Now, when in the past has complete deregulation worked out for poor people? The answer is never. In fact, the reason that we find ourselves in the situation that we're in is that the common sense guardrails that were put in place under FDR and the New Deal were completely torched by Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Obama. So what we need are those common sense guardrails put back into place. I mean, I'm speaking to you on the heels of the most devastating week that Los Angeles has ever seen. And it's really telling that these YIMBY parasites are online and mobilizing to build unregulated units before the embers have been put off on the scorched earth. A lot of the housing that was lost out there was rent controlled and protected for low and middle income people. They want all of that removed, and they want to build high-density housing, which in fact is only going to line the pockets of real estate.
And on that sobering note, I want to thank you so much, Mary Brosnahan, for your time today.
I'll just say I hope people, if they want to read an excerpt from the book, I hope it's the part about that there are solutions and there is hope.
Mary Brosnahan is the author of They Just Need to Get a Job, 50 Myths of Homelessness. She led the Coalition for the Homeless in New York for 30 years. I'm Sasha Lilly. You've been listening to Against the Grain. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.